Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The freedom to think and the freedom of religion are constitutional keystones and givens in the United States. However, when those freedoms lead a Pentecostal pastor to come out as an atheist, he is shunned by some and praised by others. Jerry DeWitt, whose ministry began when he was 17, is the author of Hope After Faith, an ex-pastor's journey from belief to atheism. He's our guest in this first of two conversations about his 25-year dialogue with faith, his early beliefs, and developing skepticism, and his embrace of free-thinking humanism. As it is for all of us, early life experiences are most often taken for granted and form the basis by which we compare subsequent experiences and develop new understandings. So when Jerry DeWitt and I visited by phone from Western Florida on December 13, 2013, we began our conversation with the description of his early childhood years.
I detail in the book that some of my earliest memories are actually of being ill, being sick, suffering with tonsillitis, suffering with earaches, suffering with really, really severe colds. And I remember laying my head in my grandmother's lap. She would apply a warm dishcloth to my ear to try to ease the pain, and then she would pray for me to the point of actually speaking in other tongues. And so that's some of the earliest memories I have. I remember the sensation as a child of being being fearful, of being nervous, being afraid. I can also remember very early on in my life running into my mom and stepdad's bedroom, finding them missing, and then going throughout the house not being able to find them. And I was convinced that the rapture had taken place and that I had been left. And that was, I'm almost certain that that was before I was even in elementary, that I had those kind of concerns. I remember walking out of music class in elementary school and hearing the other kids talk about that the moon that night was going to turn to blood. And I was already familiar enough with at least a general understanding of the book of the Revelation that I you know, felt an impending doom, that this was the end times, and that the judgment was coming, and I knew that I had not done the things that my family promoted that one had to do in order to be saved. And so I spent the rest of that school day horrified. It sounds very tragic, but unfortunately, I really did grow up in a very fearful cocoon personally.
And that fearful cocoon had a foundation or orientation towards Pentecostal aspects of Christianity.
Yes, I think it did.
Can you define some terms for us, beginning with Pentecostal?
Sure. Just that term alone can create a good bit of confusion. But generally, when a person refers to the Pentecostal denominations or the Pentecostal faith or a Pentecostal participant, really what makes the difference between Pentecostals and everything else is speaking in other tongues. An essential part of the Pentecostal doctrine is the belief that a person can be so filled by the Holy Spirit that they will experience the New Testament phenomenon of speaking in other tongues.
Jerry, can you define for us what the Holy Spirit is?
Sure.
That fills people to get them to speak in other tongues?
So for most of Christianity, the Holy Spirit is the third person of the Trinity or of the Godhead. Now, the branch of Pentecostals that I originate from, they were not Trinitarians. They considered themselves to be oneness believers, and they did not believe that God was divided into three persons, but that each Each what was referred to as persons is actually a manifestation of the one God. It's all semantics. But the Holy Spirit would be the presence of God within our reality, within our realm. You might have God in the form of Father sitting on the throne in a heavenly dimension versus God's Spirit being present with us here on the earth and thus being able to embody us, being able to flow through us, to move through us, to activate us, to inspire us, or even to speak through us, which would be considered the gift of speaking in other tongues.
Can you give us an example of what it sounds like when you hear a person speaking in other tongues?
Well, everyone's tried to get me to speak in other tongues since I've been touring, and I say I can't do it as long as my grandmother's alive, out of respect for her. But the phenomenon would be much like suddenly switching channels, and if you don't speak Spanish, ending up on a Spanish channel, and suddenly everything looks the same, but the syllables, you know, sound unfamiliar, but because the dialect is coming from a person that you're accustomed to hearing speak English, then the phrases, the patterns, the sentence sizes will still be very similar in a lot of ways. It just will be syllables that don't make any sense to you. There's a lot of repetition to it.
Staying with your personal experience, and perhaps that of others, if you could share them with us. When someone speaks in other tongues, what is the content that is being conveyed?
That is an excellent question. I would say 90% of the time, when someone is speaking in other tongues, they're actually doing it for their own edification. It's an experience, though it's being vocalized and thus it's being made public. It's really a personal experience, and it creates a total different sense, not just of edification, but of connection with the spirit world. And so many times when a person is speaking in other tongues, they're actually praying in their mind. The content would really be internal, and they would be projecting. For instance, if I was praying during a service, speaking in other tongues, in my mind, I'm actually projecting that into the invisible, projecting it towards God or towards Jesus, depending on my theology, as a form of prayer. And so it may be supplication, it may be worship, it may be praise, but very seldom is there an intention to communicate something from one human to the other through the vehicle of speaking in other tongues. When that is the intention, then it will be followed by what's called an interpretation that would be in the hearer's known language.
And that's an individual interpretation by each listener.
Correct. Generally, the speaker gives the interpretation.
So let's go back to prayer. What is prayer? How does one pray?
That's an interesting question. I think everyone approaches that at the beginning of their faith experience because you have an innate concern that maybe you're not going to do it right. And if you don't do it right, maybe it won't be successful, or it may actually be insulting to God in some way. And it can definitely lead to the fear of being embarrassed publicly if you don't pray right. So what I was taught very early on in my life was that prayer was a conversation, and that you should just talk to God, speak out, whether that was verbally or in your mind, that you should speak out to God in the same way that you would talk to a friend. So it'd be just like me talking to you. I would say to you, my friend, you're aware that my son is traveling today. I know that you have the ability to give safe travel to people when you choose to. I'm asking you to give safe travel to my son.
That's a request to the listener.
That's a supplication, correct.
There's some psychiatric beliefs that people can talk to God, but when God talks to people and tells them to do certain things, it's characterized as a hallucination.
Right, right. You know, if I don't know how far I can go with that. I think if they do hear an audible voice, then obviously they've had a hallucination. Obviously, if they see something, and I've had all those experiences. I've heard an audible voice. I've seen things, as we would say, in the flesh that were obviously hallucinations. I think most believers, they're feeling what we would call led. They're feeling prompted. They're having a thought. An impression comes to their mind, and it comes with such a clarity or an intensity that they are taught to assume that that's God speaking back to them. So if I was praying and saying, Father, do you want me to go to Walgreens or do you want me to go to CVS, you know, and I suddenly had this impression that suddenly maybe I saw a mental image of Walgreens. It just popped into my mind, or at least it feels as if it popped into my mind with some clarity, then I would have been taught that that was the Holy Spirit inside of me giving me guidance. So I'm not sure that'd be a hallucination. It's just misled.
Jerry DeWitt, I want to ask you about some more definitions. What is faith and why the characterization of God is mostly in the masculine? Before we do that, I want to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Jerry DeWitt. Jerry DeWitt is the author of Hope After Faith, An Ex-Pastor's Journey from Belief to Atheism. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Jerry, what is faith?
That's a great question. For me personally, faith is trust. It would be the conscious action of putting trust into something that still has a certain amount of unknown. You know, like for instance, you know, I would come onto your program and I would have faith. I would trust that the questions are going to be relevant to my subject matter. You know, it's something more related to trust. Now, where I came from, particularly in the hardline Pentecostal world that I grew up in, faith was almost a commodity. It was almost seen as an invisible substance because you could have less of it or more of it, and you could attempt to live a lifestyle that would help you acquire more of it over time. And the idea was that if you were not seeing the miracles that you had been promised or that you thought you should see, it was because you had yet to reach that level of faith that you needed in order to trigger these miracles to take place. And that was something that I found troubling very, very early on in my Christian experience, because I could see in the Bible that there were obviously other uses of the word faith.
For example?
A good example in the New Testament would be when you're talking about faith in regards to salvation. I think especially the Paulinian doctrine, it's very, very precise about having faith in the substitutionary sacrifice of Jesus Christ, that Christ becomes your appeasement for sin, and that all of your redemption is found in the work of the cross. And so, unfortunately, in our culture today, the word faith is used ambiguously. It's used in so many different ways. I don't think we ever really know what someone's talking about unless we really understand their context.
So staying with the words that you're using, you talk about salvation and redemption. From what?
Well, if you're a Christian, if you're evangelical, then you would be being redeemed from the inherited sin that you received from Adam. That sin has, by Christian doctrine, plagued all of humanity, and no one is righteous without the redemption that was bought and paid for by the blood of Christ. And so the way that you then become a recipient of that redemption would be to have faith in the work of Christ. And so that's within that context.
When you say all of humanity, Are you implying that it is Christian doctrine that every Homo sapien on earth is subject to the need for salvation and redemption?
Absolutely. My understanding of the Christian doctrine is that Adam, as the first human being, was the federal head in the economy of God, and whatever actions he took then would be transmitted to the rest of his descendants. And so that makes every child, every human being ever born from Adam's lineage a sinner, the same way that Adam was, and that's what a person ultimately, under Christian doctrine, would go to hell for is not necessarily the actions that they commit within their lifetime, but the very fact that they're born under the original curse of sin. And so then, when you bring Christ into the equation, Christ becomes the firstborn of a second creation. He becomes the federal head for those of his spiritual lineage, and the righteousness that he demonstrated in his life, conversely to Adam's sinfulness, is transferred to any human that then puts their faith in the work of Christ. I think that's a pretty mainstream Christian doctrine.
So can you then apply that doctrine to the concepts of evolution, of human evolution, and the evolutionary aspects in general on our earth?
You know, I the first thing that comes to my mind of how you can do that is to first acknowledge that the idea of sin, the idea of failure, must originate early in human history from, and for lack of better words, this disappointment that we can sometimes have with reality. Sickness, for example, tragedy, accidents. What would allow that to be the normal course of events in the human experience? There's, you know, if we're honest, we would have to admit that there's a fair amount of tragedy in the human experience. And so early on in our human history, looking for an explanation of why these bad things are happening, I can see the temptation would have existed to have said, well, there must be a flaw with us. There must be something wrong with us for us to end up being sick, for us to end up being frail, for us to fight through these different situations for survival through our development. And of course, over time, this all becomes congealed into, you know, religious doctrine. Now what I do is I think I try to be very passionate about removing the cultural acceptance of the idea of something's wrong with you, you know, that something is wrong with you. I don't think there's as much wrong with us as we allow ourselves to feel guilty over. I think that's a byproduct of thousands of years of one particular type of religious thinking. And in particular, I don't think our differences make us wrong. You know, for instance, people of different sexual orientations, they have to fight through this cultural acceptance that what makes them different is that something is wrong with them. And obviously, we know now that that's not the case. And so I don't think humanity should be seeking for redemption anymore, because I don't think humanity should see their origins as flawed.
How would you apply what you just said then to some indigenous theologies among the few indigenous cultures that exist throughout the world?
Well, I think there's one important part related to that question. I am learning the longer that I am outside of mainstream Christianity, just how indoctrinated I am. And how much of not just my vocabulary, but my thought process, my worldview, has been shaped and may forever be shaped by my Christian experience. And so it's almost as if I now live a life of double think, you know, instead of double speak, double think, and second guess many of my own motives and my own conclusions in order to try to make sure that I'm not making these actions, I'm not taking these actions or being motivated for something that that was given to me through my religious experience. You know, I think when we call ourselves free thinkers, we're really saying a lot, and we're really setting the bar very high. And so after 2 years now of being on the road and telling my story and being involved in the secular movement, I think I'm just now beginning to realize how indoctrinated I actually was.
Jerry DeWitt, how do you celebrate primarily Christian holidays, Christmas and Easter, for example?
The same way that I always did. You know, one of the realities of modern day Christianity is that we don't always take our own holidays very serious. You know, Christmas is all about family and gifts, and very similar when it comes to Thanksgiving and Easter. So almost nothing has changed. The Christmas tree this year does not have an angel on top. That may be a little different, but the tree is still there, and the gifts are still under it. Thanksgiving, the only thing that was different about it was that we did not, my son and I did not participate in the family prayer when everyone else was praying. Otherwise, it all seems very much the same.
In the gender characterization of God, why is it primarily in the masculine in the Christian theology?
Well, that is a fantastic question, because if we look at history earlier than Judaism, and other parts of religious history that run parallel, we see that that's not the case. You know, we know that there are female versions of deity in lots of other religious backgrounds, but Christianity comes directly from Judaism, and at least the Judaism that we're now able to study and to take part in. It has as its deity a masculine character with very masculine roles. Now we can, you know, the little bit of study that I've been able to do, I think we can look back and see that early on in Judaism's history, it wasn't exactly that way. But over time, that masculine meme apparently did win out, and that's what Christianity inherited. And so, with that being the foundation for Christianity, I don't think that that people stopped to consider the implications. Obviously, it's unfortunate, and it carries with it, I think, a lot of limitations.
Could you talk about the unintended consequences of this carryover?
Sure. I think some of the unintended consequences is the limitation of a feminine expression. And the feminine role within our societies, whenever our societies, were originating out of Christian theology and Christian philosophy, then a lot of the positive benefits and natural benefits that we could have been enjoying from the feminine role were completely done away with. And I think it may ultimately also lead to this westernized version, very westernized version of Christianity that we have, that does not embrace the mystery of anything very well. You know, in our westernized version of Christianity, it's all about chopping down the tree and counting the rings. You know, it's not about trying to appreciate the beauty of the tree itself as it stands. And that's unfortunate, because that has now brought modern-day Christianity into a position of having to almost support their faith with facts. And those two concepts are completely diametrically opposed to one another. And so in some ways you can almost feel sorry for the modern-day Christians, because they are trapped in this box of having to prove what they could have if they had come from a different direction, what they could have just simply proclaimed as unprovable, unseeable, but yet beautiful.
Well, Jerry DeWitt, I want to thank you for being with us on part one of our conversation about your life. And I want to ask you the same questions that I'll ask at the end of our second conversation. And that is, can you tell us about an epiphany or an aha moment that changed your life or something by which you now live?
You know, the very first really clear aha moment that I had was actually when I was still a Christian. And I, up until that this particular moment that I'm going to describe, I felt very responsible for my salvation. I felt as if there was certain ways I had to live, there were certain standards I had to perform to in order to be saved. And if you really understood where I came from, you would know that it was more than just being saved, but it was making sure that God's blessings was on my life and then the life of my family. If I did right, then God would do right by us. And that was very important.
Of course, there's the question of the definition of right.
That, always.
And can you tell us what you would like to do with the rest of your one precious life?
I would like to be, I would like to be a witness of nature's beauty, of life's grandeur, of the awesomeness of existence. I would like to witness life in all of its beauty as much as I can. That's my very selfish desire. And I feel as if I owe my family, I owe them the next 20 years because they pretty well paid to me with their time and energy the last 20 years. And so I want to focus on family. I want to build Community Mission Chapel. I want to continue to work with the Clergy Project and enjoy the beauty of life as it is.
And finally, Jerry, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
You know, I would say anything by Joseph Campbell. If you're just really starting out on or branching out on a new direction of your faith journey, I would say Joseph Campbell. Anything you can pick up by Joseph Campbell will open your mind to possibilities.
Well, that would be the topic of our next conversation. Jerry DeWitt, thank you very much for being with us in part one of our discussion about your life on Radio Curious.
Truly my pleasure.
Jerry DeWitt is the author of Hope After Faith, an ex-pastor's journey from belief to atheism. His website, hopeafterfaith.com, provides information about his book and links to the resources and topics discussed. The books Jerry DeWitt recommends are those written by Joseph Campbell, which may be found at the Joseph Campbell Foundation website, jcf.org. This was the first of a two-part conversation recorded on December 13, 2013. There are over 750 archives on our website, radiocurious.org, and I'm honored to tell you that Radio Curious is now part of the collection at the Library of Congress. We appreciate your cards, ideas, and letters, and do enjoy hearing from you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. The postal address is 700 West Smith Street, Ukiah, California, 95482. The phone is 707-621-5075. Ignacio Ayala is the assistant producer. I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.